Ladies and gentlemen, let's try to reconvene. We have a heavy agenda in front of us for the afternoon, and we are already running some 15 minutes late. So let's try to start this afternoon session. My name is Christophe Bellman. I'm the head of programs at the ICTSD, and I will briefly introduce the session. Just allow me to say a few quick words before I give the floor to our speakers. I think this morning we talked a lot about the importance of the numbers and the gains that could come out of the Doha round, but also of the other types of gains that might result from a successful deal, including some systemic ones. This session is going to continue in a way in this area by looking more specifically at the environmental aspects of a successful Doha deal and a number of other issues, including new and improved trade rules. When you look at the mandate of the Doha round, there are a few areas where the environment has been in a way invoked as a rationale for designing specific disciplines. Immediately the environmental goods and services or the fisheries negotiations come to mind. Now, if we want to do in a way justice to the environmental objective of the mandate, success in these negotiations won't only be measured in terms of trade gains, but also on the extent to which they might contribute to address some of the environmental problems. If you take the case of the environmental goods and services or even fisheries, the question then becomes, well, do we have something on the table which could in a way yield potential meaningful win-win situations in terms of promoting both environment, the sustainable use of natural resources, and trade gains. Environmental goods and services, we know that this is an industry that is roughly worth $700 billion now. It's becoming as big as the pharmaceutical industry. Of course, the U.S., Japan, and the EU remain major players, but developing countries are catching up very quickly. They account for roughly 20% of this industry. Their growth is almost double as the one that you find in developed countries. So there are a number of important potential gains in this area. They go beyond, of course, the pure kind of market access questions. There are questions of non-tariff barriers. There are questions of providing an enabling environment. There are questions of local content, subsidies, as we've seen recently in the press. But there is probably an interesting potential here. If you look at fisheries, this is an area where the ineffective kind of resource management schemes combined with a huge amount of subsidies, I think we're talking about something like $27 billion of subsidies, out of which probably $20 billion have potentially negative impact on the environment, and an area where a lot of the fish stocks, nearly 75% of commercial stocks are already overfished. So I think there are quite a big potential to achieve also some environmental gains and benefits in these negotiations. The fact that there are on the negotiating mandate in itself, I think, is an achievement. If you look at 10, 15 years back, this would probably have been unthinkable for many. Today, I have the feeling that having some sort of a pro-environment and at the same time pro-trade outcome in these negotiations is becoming an essential part in selling this a broader trade deal at the political level. So with this, let me just give the floor to our two speakers. First, we'll have Mr. Rahed Safari from the OECD, who is going to talk about the environmental aspects of a successful Doha deal, and he's going to talk about EGS, about agriculture, and then we'll move to our second speaker, who's going to talk about rules. So with this, please.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. When you start thinking about the Doha development agenda and the deal before us, and then you go and talk about the environmental issues and all the problems, be they climate change, be they carbon emissions, be they clean water, access to clean water, clear energy, the whole nine yards. You say to yourself, do I have to actually sell this? Do I need to sell? Isn't it this package can sell itself in and by itself? And if you think that actually trade liberalization has a contribution to make in this area. Now, I have the issues here, are very, very complex issues in terms of measurability, data, scientifically correct ways of doing things, and how you measure, a sector that has both, that is a host for the environment and produces at the same time negative externalities for the environment, and at the same time it's a public good, the whole thing, and then all the emissions coming from different nutrients, fertilizers, animal husbandry, the whole nine yards. Then you say to yourself, okay, these are complex issues, but the story is a simple one. And the story in here, if I can guess, where's the mouse? There it is. And the story is that the trade liberalization actually in goods and services will produce gains on the environmental front. I am not in a position, unfortunately, to tell you how many dollars in welfare and how many units better clean water or all these measurements. I'm not in a position to tell you this, but I can tell you for a fact that trade liberalization has a positive role to play, and it should play that role in terms of contributing to better environment. And it does so through different aspects. Now, step back and look at what we know in terms of barriers. There are the usual tariff barriers that on average can go from 10 to 12%. And, when you think about all the bulkiness of these environmental goods, right, or high-tech businesses, you think that, their storage and how many times they cross borders and how many times they actually attract more tariffs, then you start to think, okay, why do I need to increase the price of those? And then you go and do a survey with firms who will tell you that actually these are the list of non-tariff measures that actually are very, very restrictive, if not prohibitive for me. They go from testing and certifications, customs procedures, regulations, adequacy of intellectual property rights protection, and government procurement procedures and product standards. So you have serious barriers there that are preventing the producers to actually trade with those, and consumers and beneficiaries to benefit from access to these. And then you say to yourself, go back to my sellability. This is an area where you can have actually a win on the environment front, a win on the trade front, and a win on the development front. So it is actually incumbent upon us to try and determine the trade-offs, and we don't need to talk about whether you look at a Mirage modeling or a GTAP modeling. The numbers in here, they'll be contested, certainly. The scientific evidence is contested already, but we know for a fact a few things, and then they all tell us that, trade liberalization can and should contribute to a win-win-win agreement on the environment front, on the development front, and on the trade front. Now, The negotiations in this house on environmental goods and services have brought out three main issues. The first issue is the concern about dual uses, environmental versus non-environmental. Now, I'm not going to be, I don't want to joke in here, I'm behind the podium here, but, I mean, is this an issue? Patrick, is this an issue?
Enormous one.
Enormous one. What's the big problem? It is actually a big issue. A big issue with the dual uses of the environment, and which has led to the list not being finalized, and then a lot of concerns amongst negotiating parties. And then, of course, the list has grown and grown and grown, and whether to include ethanol or not to include ethanol and other products, you know, these are real political issues that need actually to be resolved in a wider agreement under the DDA. And, of course, there is also the poor coherence across all the areas of interventions in the trade aspects of these goods, be they tariff and non-tariff barriers and the barriers to trade in related services. So the issues are the barriers are high. As I said, you know, a survey of some of the firms that we tapped into in the OECD and non-OECD countries, you know, revealed that non-tariff barriers are in many cases prohibitive. And then, you know, if you look at some of the studies, and I'm just going to choose two of them here, one by the World Bank, you know, that looked at liberalizing a small number of low-carbon goods, four of them actually, and to see what are the trade gains, not the environmental gains, and then they see... In 18 developing countries would lead, they say, to 7% trade gains if only tariffs are removed, and 13% if both tariffs and non-tariff barriers were removed. Now, another work that has actually attempted to measure these is the ISD work that has taken the list, the Friends of EGS list of 153 goods, and its conclusion that the impact on greenhouse gas emissions is almost exclusively due to the list's inclusion of renewable electricity generation technologies, which means that of all the 153 items there, only one item actually did produce some, in there at least, in the model that they have devised, some gains on the environmental front in terms of the impact on greenhouse gas emissions. Now, but there are boundary approach for a lot of studies that have taken a closer look at this is that, you know, such removal of tariffs on only tariffs will contribute to less than 5% of savings in the greenhouse gas emissions business. And that's a small number because of all the limitations, and I'd rather see it as being small rather than being exaggerated. But it confirms one important thing is that, you know, if you move forward on this front, you can actually realize gains in terms of the environment and climate-friendly technologies, right? But we need to be aware that two key conditions need to be satisfied so that we can have an agreement that will actually, we can say with confidence that it will contribute to environmental objectives. So we need a broader coverage. As you can see, that, you know, the list already, according to some studies, has few elements that will make a contribution or some kind of contribution to environment, realizing some environmental objectives. And accompanying measures, of course, will be necessary to ensure that the potential for uptake offered by trade liberalization is actually exploited, so that you need focus on non-tariff barriers and, of course, an attention to the capacity of host countries to absorb the new technologies that we're talking about. Now, that's on the environmental goods and services. It's all good stories. The numbers are, you know, they indicate some kind of a positive relationship and positive impact. And in here, on the environment is even more complicated because, as I began to say, the environment is both a host and an offender, right? So in terms of its impact in here, this is and it's very localized, so that, you know, you need data at the very localized farm level to find out exactly what is happening to, in order to measure and then come up with a GTAP or a Mirage or what have you. But we know that due to its particularities, this agricultural sector needs to actually make a contribution to adaptation and to mitigation. So it has an important role to play here. And we know that actually, you know, the agriculture accounts for 70% of world freshwater withdrawals and 45% in OECD countries. And a lower bound estimate of its contribution to greenhouse gases says 14%. That's a lower bound. And land use and land use changes and forestry account for a further 17%. So put together, a lower bound of 31%, I mean, this is an important sector that needs to be looked at very carefully. So, and as I said, you know, this agricultural sector that has throughout history shown a great ability to adjust to changing conditions will be called upon, in fact, to do both, to adapt and to mitigate the effects on environment. But one way of doing this is to actually rely on markets. You rely on market to resolve the different pressures that the agro-food sector is facing, to resolve climate change and resource scarcity issues. We know of no other mechanism, better mechanism than this. And when where markets do not exist, of course, I mean, this is your standard answer. We need to create them. So it is a positive and negative externality and a public good at that, right? And we need to factor all these in as we try and seek market-based solutions. And where markets do not or fail, we need to actually provide for a solution there too. Now, it is a truism to say that the WTO is actually part of the solution here. And trade and an efficiently functioning international trading system in the WTO is a key framework condition, or will be a key framework condition, that will allow global supply to match global demand and then meeting also consumer requirements for quality and variety. This is the place. Now, and we know that production patterns across the globe are shifting, and the general consensus is that, you know, you'll have food deficit regions and food surplus regions, and in order for demand and supply to match, you need international trade and you need it to flow freely and in a credible manner. And therefore, you know, like, international trade will have to depend on international trade to actually make an important contribution to connecting both food surplus and food deficit areas. And of course, in parallel, the development strategies that are needed to create employment outside agriculture, right, as people move outside the sector, and will have to be created. And the multilateral trading system actually has a key role to play in all this. But at the same time, we know from Economics 101 that where you need to intervene in terms of the environment has to be where the environmental problem arises, and therefore instruments there. But at the same time, you know, let's not forget that, as I said, agricultural policy reform and trade liberalization are really a necessary but not sufficient conditions. And without improvement of the supply capacity in many poor countries, they will not be able to respond to markets. And both private and public investments are needed. And all of these things can only happen in an environment that is credible, that is transparent, with rules of the game that everyone knows, right? And then we can move forward on this one. And therefore, it is actually an important role that the WTO system has to play in here. And of course, we know that at the end of the day, farmers react to price signals, market signals. And the choices they make on the farm are the choices that can affect in one way or another the environment. So any attempt to actually deal with environment in this sector, we'll have to start actually by reforming the agricultural sector itself, where governments have interfered to actually change the incentives and change the signals to farmers. They have inadvertently created a negative impact on the environment. So just to name a few, agricultural support programs, import restrictions on biofuels and fossil fuel subsidies. Imagine, I mean, in this case, we go subsidize fossil fuels. It is, in this area, it is very telling what will the impact. I mean, I don't need to measure it for you, but you can sense to what extent that will have an impact. And all these interventions, actually, they were there, and although they are being reformed, as I will explain further, through time, they still have the negative impact on the environment. And, of course, the subsidization of agricultural production and what have you have had an impact on the overexploitation of natural resources. Now, as I said, the reforming of the agricultural policies is definitely a plus for the environment. And the OECD countries are responding through, you know, reforms of their own. So now the decoupling business has already started, and I will show you some numbers. But the story is not there, because we have moved from very distortive to less distortive, but still nonetheless distortive pressure, distortive policies. And in here, where is that, those numbers? The level of support actually is down from 37% in the OECD. This is only, these numbers apply only to the OECD area. Level of support is down from 37% of farm receipts in 86-88 to 23%. And the share of the most production, trade distorting production support is also down from 86% in 1986-88 down to 56% now. So it is a forward movement, but still 56% are still tied to production performance. And therefore, the implementation of more decoupled policy instruments has played we're moving in the positive direction, but no more needs to be done, and you need to actually begin there. So, if you remember, the story on the agriculture is very straightforward. First, what incentives, what government policy has done to actually dissociate farmers from receiving market signals? Those would need to be removed, and already, you know, and we see movement to that in that direction, and that, in fact, is the decoupling that. What we'll call decoupling from production. And then, of course, at the same time, you need policies that will come in to tackle the problem at the source of the problem, which is environmental policies. And a WTO agreement in this area will have a, as I said, once again, will contribute to both, to all three targets, environment, trade, and development. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Safadi. Let's move immediately to our next speaker, Mr. André Sapir from the Université Libre de Bruxelles. You have 20 minutes.
Thank you. Let me just put this. Can I put this? No.
You don't need it.
No. I can't put it.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much to the WTO for the invitation to talk about rules. Now, we have heard this morning several excellent presentations that try to put some numbers, and this is something that, you know, we as economists we like to put some numbers, and I think it's very legitimate that we want to put numbers on any kind of possible deals that is being envisioned, and in truth, obviously, we can put numbers on some parts of what is being discussed in the negotiations, but we really can't put numbers on others. And I would say that it's easier, I'm not saying easy, it's easier to put numbers on the part of the WTO work that relates to the exchange of concession on market access. What I'm going to be talking about right now is about the other function, the other main function of the WTO, which is rulemaking. Now, rulemaking, we all recognize that it's extremely, extremely important function, maybe even more important function than the market access and the exchange of concession function, but yet it's of an intangible nature. We can't really put it into our model, or if we put it into our model, we do it in an extremely crude manner. So I'm not going to provide you with the numbers, none that I have tried to come up with, nor really do I see that studies generally make even heroic attempt at providing numbers. So we are going to be not talking about numbers at all, and I'm just going to say this is an extremely important area, it's a crucial area, but I can't give you a number. Neither euro, nor dollars, nor yuan, nor in any other currency. Now, what concerns rules, in a sense, in the context of the WTO, in the context of the multilateral trading system, in a sense, always relates to the basic principles of the system, the principles of non-discrimination, the principle of mutual reciprocity, and I think a third one, which sometimes we forget, which is equally crucial, is transparency. So those three principles, non-discrimination, mutual reciprocity, or multilateral reciprocity and transparency, are really the fundamental principles on which most of the rules of the system are built. Now, the rules and those principles, well, we know, they go back to 1947, to the creation of the GATT, and over the history since 1947, some of the rules have been updated, some rules have been added, others have remained largely unchanged. And yet, we all recognize that the world and the world of business and the world of trade has changed so importantly. And after all, when we are talking of globalization today, I think we are really talking about two things. We are talking about, number one, the fact that the role of emerging and developing countries in the world trading system is totally different from what it was in the late 40s, in the early 50s, and thankfully so. But the other is certainly all the technological changes that have occurred, more recently information technology, and that means that over all of those years, the way firms do business today is not at all similar to the way firms were doing business when the original GATT rules, even those that were updated at the time of the Uruguay round and the creation of the WTO, those rules, they were for a different functioning of business than it is today. So the point I'm trying to make is that we had rules created at the creation of the GATT in the late 40s. Those rules were updated during the different rounds, and in particular during the Uruguay round 15 years ago. But since then, the world has changed tremendously, and one does need to update the rules. And I think there are a number of areas where that needs to be done. So I'm not saying that one is to rewrite, quite on the contrary. I think the basic principles that we have are very sound principles, but based on those principles, we have rules, and those rules, they need to better take into account the way business is being conducted today and the kind of membership that we have and the changes in comparative advantage that have occurred. No, in the current round, in the Doha round, there is a negotiating group on rules, as you very well know, and this group only looks at some of the rules that we generally consider to be the trading rules, the basic rule of the system. And as you know, the negotiating group on rules is working on four areas: anti-dumping, number one; number two, subsidies and countervailing measures; number three, in relationship to what we discussed, the fisheries subsidies, a new issue, and then the fourth issue on the agenda of the negotiating group is the matter of regional trade agreements. Now, what I'm going to do is spend a little bit of time on each of those four issues, and let me start with the last one, the regional trade agreements. I think there is a very good example of what I said a moment ago, of how things have changed tremendously, certainly since 1947, but even since 1995, since the creation of the WTO. We all know that today there are nearly 500 regional trade agreements, counting separately goods and services, that have been notified to the WTO under the different agreements, and nearly 300 agreements are in force today. Just to give you a comparison, in 96, a little after the creation of the WTO, when the Committee on Regional Trade Agreement was created, there were at that time only about 112 RTAs in force. So we have gone from 112 to nearly 300 today in the span of 15 years. And I think it's probably good to remember that clearly Article 24 of the GATT that authorizes the creation of regional trade agreements, of customs union and free trade areas. As I always say, this article was put to be number 24. And it's an exception to Article 1, the MFN article. Clearly, it was never envisioned that we would have the kind of proliferation of regional trade agreements that we have today. I'm not making a value judgment whether it's good or bad. What is clear is that it was seen as an exception, and as an exception that, as some of you will probably remember, originally we were just thinking about customs union, and then came the free trade area possibility, and 90% or more of the regional trade agreements today are in the form, in fact, of the free trade area, which was not really envisioned. So here is really a situation where the original rules are not at all commensurate to the kind of evolution that we have had, and where I think indeed it's very, very good that this negotiating group is attempting to make some progress on the rules in this area, since we know that Article 24 in terms of goods and Article 5 in terms of services, that both authorizes the creation of regional trade agreements for goods and for services, the text of those articles, 24 for goods and 5 for services, is rather vague, I would say, and therefore one can't say that they are allowing any disciplining effect. And I think this is really the problem. The problem is perhaps not so much the fact that there is a proliferation of regional trade agreements, is that one doesn't really know what one should be looking for, how to evaluate them. This famous Committee on Regional Trade Agreements, which is supposed to make an evaluation of the agreements that are notified, how does it really do the evaluation without having guidelines that are well specified? Now, some progress has been made in the group already. Back in December 2006, there was a provisional adoption of the transparency mechanism on regional trade agreement, and I think certainly that was a useful step forward, and there is work going on based on this transparency mechanism. There is work in the within the committee, and I should add that in a couple of days the WTO will host a conference on those matters, and so there is indeed work, and I think there is very much realization not just in this house, but I think there is realization in the everybody who is involved in trade negotiation, that regional trade agreements have become a very, very important element on which trade negotiators are spending a lot of their energy, and that one should worry about the extent to which those regional trade agreements are really compatible or not with the multilateral trading system. What I would argue here, we are not going to go back to saying, you know, are we going to roll back or not those agreements. I think this is not the issue. The issue is to introduce, indeed, as we have already started to do, is to introduce more transparency and better ways also for the Secretariat to evaluate those agreements and to allow countries, especially third parties, to be able to understand what is going on. So this is the first issue, regional trade agreements. Second issue on the agenda of the negotiating group is anti-dumping. Now, anti-dumping, it's not the first time that anti-dumping is on the agenda of the group on rules. That was already the case during the Uruguay round. One can't say that during the Uruguay round much progress was done on those negotiations. And my feeling is that there's not a huge amount of progress being made at the moment either, although there's been a lot of submissions. But judging from the text that was put forward in December 2008 by the chair, or the previous chair of the negotiating group, that produced, I think, a lot of disagreement on the part of members, one sees that one is still some distance away from coming to a consensus about how we should progress in reforming the rules. At the same time, and it's very much like in the area of regional trade agreements, where so much has happened and there is so much need to update the rules, this is also the case in anti-dumping. Remember what was the situation in the quote-unquote old days. There were a few traditional users of anti-dumping, going back to the original ones, Canada, Australia, right? Those are the real original ones at the beginning of the 20th century, and then obviously the European Union and the US. And they were very much, and still are, very important users. So, and they were called the traditional users. Now, next to the traditional users, we have lots of other users. Many of the developing countries have introduced legislation on anti-dumping. In fact, between 1980 and 2003, the number of countries with legislation, GATT WTO members with anti-dumping legislation, went from 36 to 97. Now, there are two ways to look at this huge increase in the number of countries, mostly developing countries, that have introduced legislation on anti-dumping. There is a good side and there's a bad side. Now, what is the good side? The good side, which is often put forward, and I think rightly so, is that the anti-dumping legislation has been introduced by countries more or less simultaneously with trade liberalization. So one can say, well, it's a safety valve in the system. It's countries, so it's good that, in a sense, it's a reflection of the fact that there's lots of liberalization. So because there is lots of liberalization, countries that are doing that, they wanted to take a guarantee that they would be able to have protection against abuse of the system. And indeed, for instance, if you look at Brazil, Brazil. Brazil introduced, liberalized in a major way in 88, introduced anti-dumping legislation in 89. India, 91, 93. Mexico, 85, 87. So you can see for many of the developing countries, in particular the emerging countries, you see that there is this almost simultaneity between the change of trade policy towards liberalization and the introduction of the anti-dumping measure. So you can say, well, it's a small price to pay for liberalization. And I think to some extent that is right. At the same time, statistical work or econometric work that has been done by a number of trade economists do find that there is what they refer to as a trade chilling effect of anti-dumping legislation. So it's not just that the anti-dumping legislation is there in case of need and it's providing this safety valve. No, it is actually being used, and this actual use is actually having a negative impact on trade. So you can say on balance, the trade liberalization has not been fully obviously upset by the anti-dumping measures, but there is some upset that has taken place. Now, I think here, once again, I don't think that anybody is talking, even though there's lots of disagreement in this negotiation and different countries are demanding different things, I don't think that there is any reasonable assumption that one is going to roll back anti-dumping rules. I think much of the need that there is, it's a bit like in the RTA, is to have much more transparency. And transparency at the different stages of the anti-dumping procedures, not just at the beginning, but also concerning the sunset clauses and other steps of the procedure. The third area, which I'm going to skip, is the area of subsidies and countervailing measures. Jeff Schott this morning told us, you know, how important it is, and it clearly is. It was also on the agenda of the rules negotiation during the Uruguay round. I think some progress was done there. There was some progress, much more than in the case of anti-dumping, and I think that is serving us well, but clearly there is much, much more work to be done. And also a matter of contention. Now, the last area of the negotiating group is this new area dealing with fishery subsidies. So the subsidies issue is already on the table, but here the notion is sort of to open a new, maybe a new annex to the subsidies and countervailing measure agreement specific to fisheries. Now, the chair recalled some of the facts, and the facts that usually come from the FAO, indicating that already 80% of world fish stocks are either fully or over-exploited, and that this is the case also for the 10 most important species. So I think, again, globally, there is recognition that there is overfishing, that something needs to be done about it. Now, there's no disagreement about that yet in the group, in the negotiating group, on the subsidies matter. I think there is a very, very deep division. And I think I'm not really surprised that there is deep division, because this issue, very much like Raed Safadi brought, you know, with environment, with climate change, those are issues onto which everybody can agree at the global level. They are global issues we need to act. The real problem is a distributional one. So how to find a system whereby countries can agree, and can agree also on the allocation of the gains and the costs of curtailing the fishing. Now, my view is that one cannot probably ask too much of a trade agreement to solve this problem. This needs to be embedded into a broader agreement, which is presumably outside of the WTO, which is not a trade agreement, which is an agreement on fishing. There have been various attempts to do this, and one needs certainly to have an enforceable global agreement on fisheries. And I think if that were the case, if we could reach that, then there is, I think, a role for the trade part. So I don't think that the trade part doesn't have a role to play here, but I think it's only a minor component of something which is much, much wider, and I think the same applies obviously in terms of climate change. Now, let me conclude. The conclusion I want to make is that, yes, let's not forget about this function of the WTO, which is about rulemaking. We can't quantify it, but we all know in our guts that this is extremely important, maybe even the most important function of the WTO. It's a function that has served the multilateral trading system very well, and I think it's right that as we are seeing in this round, we are tackling new issues. It's not just the anti-dumping and subsidies countervailing as in the previous round. It has been expanded to new areas. Regional trade agreements, very, very much needed because of what has happened, the proliferation. I have said something about the fisheries, but all of those matters of those new areas, natural resources, climate change, they will need to be tackled at some stage, some of them obviously in the future. So let's keep the work. Let's try to get a deal that will also encompass some improvement of the rules, but this work will certainly continue after this round. Thank you.
Thank you very much, André. Let me turn now to our discussant, Mr. Pradeep Mehta. I think the two speakers covered a wide range of issues, you know, from EGS, agriculture, the rules negotiations. It's very broad. Don't feel obliged to comment on all of them, but I think it would be good to get some of your reactions to get the discussion started. So, Pradeep, you have 10 minutes.
Thank you. Thank you, Christoph. And to begin with, let me also thankfully acknowledge with gratitude the invitation extended by the WTO, the World Bank, and the ICTSD for this event. And let me see, as you rightly said, Christoph, there's a very wide variety or wide range of issues covered by both the speakers, and within 10 minutes, I do not know as to what justice I could do to them. But indeed, I'm not going to cover all the issues, but just mention some of the critical issues which I feel are important. Let me first begin with a quote from Albert Einstein. He said, "We can't solve problems by using the same kind of thinking when we use to create them." And that sort of underlines or underpins what I'm about to say in terms of the areas that both the speakers touched upon in a wide canvas. I made a very important point about the complexity of the whole negotiation on environmental goods and services, including the fact is that it cuts across a very large swath of issues as we debate today, not only the Doha round, but as well as the climate change negotiations. I think not enough stress or not enough emphasis has been made on as to what is happening in the area of climate change negotiations. And both these speakers, or rather I would say the session addresses a very large number of issues which are one day or the other going to get into the other aspect of this debate, including to pick up on the last point made by Andre Sapir was the issue about fisheries, whether it should be a trade agreement or whether it should be an agreement on its own, another multilateral environmental agreement, or whether it will come under the climate change rubric, we do not know. And that, again, reflects the complexity which Riyadh mentioned specifically, but which was covered in quite a detail by Andre Sapir in his own presentation as well. The second aspect or the second important point which I take from both the speakers is the issue of non-tariff measures. Riyadh spoke about it in great detail, and when you look at the whole issue of rules, the rubric of rules is basically to regulate non-tariff measures in order to ensure that trade flows smoothly. What we can see very clearly is and that it is going to become a major, major issue as we move along in this path of a World Trade Organization, is whether it is through the multilateral trading system or through any other bilateral trading system. The one issue that we are facing in a very major negotiation which India is engaged in with the European Union on a bilateral free trade agreement is the issue of social clause. And this is something which the speaker did not allude to, but it is something which continues to remain on the agenda of the WTO and something which will continue to pop up like a hydra-headed monster. I mean, you put it down in one place and it comes up in another place. And therefore, you'll find that a large number of these issues will behave like hydra-headed monsters. The gain in terms of the win-win philosophy, or as Raj spoke about the triple win, in fact, it was only about 3 years ago when this very room, there were two conferences on a back-to-back basis. One was on trade and environment, and the other was then on trade and development. With that realization that you have to create a kind of access between all these three important issues, you cannot just deal with a bilateral set of issues, trade and environment, because it's not going to go along with the membership of or the international community as such. So there is a need for better coherence when we speak about this, and coherence which can be perceived by all the negotiating countries as being beneficial for their own rights, or at least not being further restrictive on their rights to remain within the system. And that has always been a central problem. And that kind of paradigm then comes again in any area of negotiation as well, as to whether it is fair to all or not. Now, increase in production and trade and environmental goods and services will certainly be beneficial to climate change. There's no doubt about it. It will lead to lower emissions as well as against the other goods and services which have been produced in a conventional manner. I mean, people do not know whether it's coal-burning thermal power stations, slowly switching over to gas-based thermal power stations and so on. But the fact is that coal-based power stations will continue to operate and emit a higher amount of carbon dioxide than what the others do. So what we are looking at is how do we approach many of these issues in a way that they will continue, how do we balance them? Some amount of environmental degradation will continue to take place at the same time. Secondly, the issue about EGS is often, which is debated here as well, is the issue of transfer of technology and the kind of cost which is associated with it. Something which I did not touch upon in your presentation. I thought that was very important, because it's not just issue of liberalization. You mentioned very interestingly about this issue of how do you change the agriculture policy to bring it in line with Sweden. But the kind of issues which require to be resolved in the area of agriculture in terms of its impact on environment then goes to touch the very fundamental nature of agriculture itself as to how you're going to do it. You did speak about the fact is that the total amount of subsidies as a percentage of the producer support has been coming down, but in absolute terms, they've been going up, and that is something which has to be also seen, and in fact continues to remain a very major contentious part of the Doha negotiations itself. If you look at the economic aspect of it. The problem again is that how do you ensure that technology to deal with a large number of these issues is available in a free manner? And that is something which will continue to remain as a big challenge. Let me now come to the presentation or the points made by Andre in his own remarks on rules. And like other discussions, I too have sort of made my own notes, not knowing exactly what the speakers are going to speak, but anticipating as to what they're going to speak. Anti-dumping is certainly very important. And that is, again, a very important aspect of negotiation. Something which you perhaps did miss out is the issue about the negotiations which are going on zeroing in. And that is a very major contentious area which, you know, many countries do not agree with. Then the issue about the demand for strict implementation of the lesser duty rule, in the sense that how the duties are calculated is. The fact is that as an organization, we are against anti-dumping. A thing which doesn't come out very well in these debates is the issue of cost and benefit to your own economy. And it's the kind of thing which we do on a very, we I don't say that we've done any kind of thorough research, but the fact is that even on shallow research, we find that the user industry is often up in arms the moment there is an anti-dumping duty. I mean, India, as most of you know, has been a major user of anti-dumping. And we often see very clearly, evidently it is quite clear that there is a vested interest behind the imposition of anti-dumping duty. And the fact is that the user industry then clamors that, look, our costs are going to go up. So I don't know whether governments have actually been able to deal with it. We tried to find as to whether public interest is at all a factor in the application of anti-dumping duty, and we found that it really doesn't has not been used anywhere at all. It doesn't exist in many laws. It exists in the EU anti-dumping law, but has never been used as such. And an important point, which I think is something which needs to be done. The issue which you spoke about, Andre, about RTAs, lack of transparency, is something which has been bothering all for a long time. And the fact is, yes, most of these issues in the world trading system start off innocuously. They started off with the issue of customs union, and then you find that they spread into a very large area. Another important issue of rules as such, rules broadly speaking, TRIPS, that also started off in the Euro round on with the innocuous issue of counterfeit goods. And today you find a plurilateral agreement being conducted outside, or having been signed probably, on an agreement on counterfeit goods, which is going to create more and more problems. Now, a kind of externality of this kind, rulemaking, which is happening, needs also to have it's going to have an impact on as to how you work out in these kind of, how do you work out in a multilateral organization like the WTO. Even in RTAs, by and large, whatever happens in terms of rulemaking does comply to a large extent with what you agree with, whether it's Article 1 or Article 5 or Article 24, by and large. But I thought it is important to draw out that particular example in terms of rulemaking. And the fact is that TRIPS itself is one of the contradictory agreements which came about in the WTO as being anti-liberalization, with which both of us agree, but it is there already. Now, at that time, you're right, Andre, when you said that when countries were liberalizing, at that time they realized that they required to bring in these kind of market regulatory instruments, which not only included anti-dumping, but included these laws like consumer protection laws and competition laws, etc. So 1990s saw a very huge shift in this kind of thing as to how do you, and something which was referred to by Aditya Mattu in his own presentation, that, you know, when countries start realizing that with liberalization, you're going to get into more and more market failures as such, and therefore you need to have these laws in place. But whether these laws are being used correctly or rightly and fairly is something which has not been discussed at the kind of depth which is required to be discussed. The only time I remember was when there was a WTO working group on trade and competition policy under Fred Jenny's chairmanship, when a large number of these issues were discussed on the platform. And I think that is necessary, that it could be discussed in another study group so that it can be discussed more threadbarely without the fear of the fact that you're going to make commitments if it is done in a negotiating group. On fishery subsidy, 2 minutes? 1 minute, okay. On fishery subsidy, then let me just make my statement here rather than to get into the debate as such, is to remind you about the Hong Kong ministerial declaration. Patrick, may I? You look puzzled. No, I mean, the issue about the fact is, let us not forget that there are very large number of poor people in the developing countries who depend upon coastal fisheries. And the fact is that whatever is the kind of agreement which arrives at has to bear in mind the special and differential treatment which would be applicable to these kind of areas, and they should not be swept into one kind of paintbrush kind of move. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Pradeep, for covering such a wide range of issues in your 10 minutes. Let me now open the floor for questions and remarks. What I'll do is just ask you to introduce yourself and be brief as possible so that we can take a number of questions. So the floor is open.
Yes.
Rachel Shub with the U.S. Mission here in Geneva. I want to thank the speakers for acknowledging that despite the array of studies out there, all of them do acknowledge that liberalizing environmental goods will have a beneficial effect on the environment, although the measurement is difficult and inconsistent and so forth and so on. I mean, I guess the point is that it's not a panacea for all of the environmental ills in the world, but it will help. So that's sort of our mandate, so it's very helpful to get that acknowledgement from the various speakers. On the NCBs, I just was interested, people are emphasizing this, and NCBs is part of the mandate to eliminate or reduce as appropriate NCBs on any environmental goods. And I was wondering, to the extent that any of the studies have looked at this, are they looking at product-specific NCBs or across-the-board sorts of NCBs like we're talking about in trade facilitations, like customs holdups and that sort of thing? That would be interesting, I think, to hear a little bit more about. Is it a product by product NCB that was looked at, and if so, what particular products, or are they focused in any specific product areas? Thank you.
Thank you. Let me see if there's any further comments or questions.
Something that was pointed out was this issue of access to technology in the environmental goods area and environmental goods and services. You identified the problem but yet did not give any ideas as to how we could solve this problem, a problem that would be very acute for the developing countries. What do you suggest could be done in the WTO to overcome this hurdle and to facilitate transfer of technology in the environmental area from the developed world, which most likely will be developing this technology because they have the capital to invest in research and development, and then to be able to spread this technology to the developing world, which will very much need it. And the other issue that you mentioned was on fishery subsidies. And while I agree that development dimension needs to be taken into account, we need also to remember what the agreement is going to be about. It's not going to be an agreement regulating fishery. It's going to be an agreement regulating subsidies provided to fishermen. So we're not going to be telling the fishermen you don't longer have the right to fish, but there are going to be rules on what government support they may get. And this is where my question is. So far I haven't seen much studies to that could tell us how prevalent are subsidies in the fisheries of developing countries, especially at the artisanal level or the coastal level. That's something that is still an open question that I would like to see tackled by the researchers. So thank you.
Thanks. Anybody else? So if that's not the case for the moment, let me go back to our speakers, and we might have time for another round of questions afterwards. So we basically had a question on NTBs in EGS. Are you looking at product-specific NTBs or kind of across the board? I would be tempted to add, well, if they're across the board and not specific to EGS, then, why deal with it in the EGS negotiations? Then we had a discussion on access to technology and EGS. Maybe, Raj, you might want to comment on it, but probably Pradeep as well, on technology transfer. And finally, on fisheries and the in a way, do we have any sense of how much subsidies are being provided to particularly artisanal fisheries in developing countries? So, Raj, you want to
let me begin? I mean, with the NTP question, right? There was a survey done with 136 firms, and they were asked to identify 36 firms in the 136 firms, environmental goods and services. This is their business, right? In a compiled list that the OECD has compiled, actually, in terms of those goods and services that dates back to 10 years ago, and the respondents actually identified in total 19 different NTBs specific to the environmental goods and services sectors. And what I have listed was the frequency analysis of the most egregious ones. And of course, many of them, I can't tell you the exact number, the majority, I would say, are vertical measures, right? Although they apply also, of course, to the sector. And of course, if you were to look at the testing and certification, they are not more egregious in as far as the sector is concerned, they're vertical. The same goes for the customs procedures and regulations on payments, and of course the government procurement aspects of it. So it is a combination of vertical and specific, right? But these were actually identified by the firms doing business in those sectors.
Thanks. André, do you want to comment on the fisheries, and then I'll move to Pradeep on both fisheries and EGS?
If I may, I wanted to comment on something that Pradeep raised. if you want to reverse.
No, that's fine. Okay. Why don't you start?
Yeah. One of the points I wanted to raise was what you discussed about the cost benefit for your country in anti-dumping. That's a very good suggestion, but I think it does fit very much with the transparency. So I would put that under that heading. So anything that would improve transparency, including publicity, on anti-dumping, then allows the conduct of those kind of studies. I mean, we know, one can obviously go a step further and have something like a public interest clause, okay? And that mandates, then you go beyond the directly affected parties, right, to third party. But I think, again, I think the key to all of this is transparency. Once you have transparency, that allows also institutes to allow researchers to conduct studies. I mean, I think the World Bank has been extremely useful in the area of anti-dumping by compiling numbers. You know, we have data banks. What has been made available to researchers to look at? But I think that's all part of the transparency. So I mean, what I'm frustrated in a sense with in this area, which I think is very similar to the RTAs. We were in a world before where there were very few users of RTAs. There were very few users of anti-dumping measures. Now that everybody uses them, you would think there should be much more demand by the membership to say, let's all put it on the table, and let's have greater transparency, greater monitoring. And there is clearly a role also for the WTO to play a role in monitoring and in making it again available. Then parties will do the cost-benefit analysis and will negotiate on those things.
Pradeep.
Can we start with the last comment?
Transparency alone is not sufficient. It's the intention of the government in order to ensure. Let me tell you of a case. The anti-dumping authority in India, a friend of mine said that, look, Pradeep, I'm sorry, I can't do anything, because if the complainant brings forward a case proving injury, and the fact is that, against Chinese goods. Now, China is not a market economy. With the result, you can't get data, many times Chinese manufacturers do not come and even defend their case. It's the local importer who defends the case, so he's already hamstrung. Just giving you one example. Now, we have, every anti-dumping action is put on the website, and notices, notifications, everything is issued, and until the time, so transparency is very high, but that is not sufficient. In India, we also have what is called the Right to Information Act, which we also use. In case if you want to get deeper into this, please show us all the files and so on. That is not the issue. The issue is, and unless we often find if the user industry is powerful enough, or if they are able to make enough noise that the anti-dumping action is not taken place, it falls. But generally it doesn't happen. Now, answering about that EGS and the issue about access to technology, basically it's not only the developed to developing country, but also a very large number of cases are happening between developing and developing countries, southern-south-south cooperation in the area of transfer of technology, transfer of what I call appropriate technology, rather than very costly technology which is required to send a man to moon and so on. There are a lot of simple issues are already being done, and there's a lot of evidence of that. It may not be captured in research documents done by OECD, but then it is there. Somebody has to pick it up and do it. What requires to be done is that there has to be a good incentive system in place in the Western economies which can incentivize their manufacturers or the public funded institutions to be able to share technology, number one. Number two is that the agreement, often the problem comes is the TIPS which comes in the way in terms of transfer of technology. That also then has to be modified in order to deal with, it's not, now you can, there's one simple thing in TIPS in public health, you can order compulsory licensing for a public health issue or if there's an emergency of nature. But what happens to a slow poisoning which is happening? It's not an emergency measure. So if in case a technology which can serve the wider public benefit, and if it is proven like this, then there has to be some kind of compulsory licensing provision available against that also. That look, okay, you can ask for that to happen. And again, I can give you a lot of examples there as to where it can be done, but there's no time. And the third issue is the
fishery subsidies.
Fishery subsidies. Now, in terms of coastal shipping, artisanal shipping, you do have some kind of small subsidy schemes that the trawler is subsidized or a subsidy is given to that. Now, there are a lot of cases that I can give you examples that maybe that the net subsidy might still be in the negative rather than positive. The fact is there is subsidy being given, but if that gets affected by the fishery subsidy discussion which is happening here, that is where we said that those should be carved out of it.
Well, thanks. I'm being told that the coffee is ready. We're already running a bit late. So what I'll do is first thank all the speakers and just tell you that we should reconvene at quarter to four. And please join me in thanking all our speakers for this session. Thank you.